Earlier in the show, we mentioned Texas leads the nation in teen births. Well, on the other end of the spectrum, it also leads the nation in executions. Since the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976, Texas has executed more death row inmates than any other state, 405. My next guest is someone who has a very intimate knowledge of the system. Pastor Carol Pickett was the death house chaplain at the Walls Prison Unit in Huntsville, Texas, from 1982 to 1995, and was witness to over 95 executions. His story is told in a new documentary, At the Death House Door, directed by Steve James and Peter Gilbert, the makers of Hoop Dreams. It premieres on IFC on May 29th. Pastor Pickett, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for letting me.
Now, let's get to your story. You became a prison chaplain in Huntsville in 1979, and shortly after, Texas resumed executions by lethal injections, which was a new method at the time. What was your reaction when you heard this?
Complete shock. We didn't even think about executions, even though the death house was in our on our unit. Mm. It was at the far end, and they hadn't had any executions since 1964, and it wasn't in my job description, and so I didn't even think about it. Nobody thought about it. Nobody that worked at the prison by that time had ever been involved in an execution, and all of a sudden we get this announcement from the warden: we're going to have an execution on December the 7th.
So what? How did your job responsibilities change?
Well, I had to start all over with a different philosophy. My work there at the prison was among inmates who were had all different types of problems. I had a hospital there, and the hospital we had the third floor, and there were 100 patients there that were all dying, and I called it my death row. Hmm. Because they were all dying, and they had heart disease, COPD, AIDS, all of those type of diseases. And I was there, you know, 4 or 5 times a week because they died.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my dying ministry. And then in December of 1982, the warden called together and said, you know, we're going to have an execution. Well, nobody knew what we were doing. Because nobody in the world had ever done a lethal injection. Nobody in the world.
So you were at the first lethal injection that ever happened?
Right.
And your new responsibilities entailed, you would sit with the prisoners on the last day of their lives from 6 a.m. until after midnight, and you would have had no prior contact with some of them. What were those days like for you?
They varied with the individual. They varied completely with individuals because it depended upon their faith. It depended upon their crime. It depended on whether or not they were innocent. It depended on whether or not they were young. It depended on whether or not they were mentally retarded.
Mm-hmm.
There were all sorts of different types of individuals. And so I had to adjust my ministry, which I called the ministry of presence, to be there because I was there all day long. And to adjust it to that one at a time. Since there were no documents, nobody had ever executed anybody by lethal injection. Nobody knew what's going to happen.
Pastor, how do you know what to say to someone when you're the last person he'll ever be with?
I began by, I was the first one they saw when they came in the death house. That was the warden's plans. That he wanted me to be the first one because I did not represent security. And most people on death row do not like security, which is the guards. And I was the only one that would be down there that did not have on a gray uniform. So that would, to him, would be bringing somebody to them that's peaceful, that does not exercise authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I would basically meet them after they were strip searched and put in the cell, go shake hands with them, which shocked most of them. It's against the rules for an inmate to touch the hand of a staff member. But I broke the rule anyway because it was his last day, and what are they going to do to him?
Mm.
So I would shake his hand and tell him who I was, and most of the time I would just let him set the subject and the pace and what he wanted to talk about. And except later on at night, I would have to ask them some legal questions, and then I would have to discuss with them what it was going to be like. But otherwise, I just listened to them, answered questions. We talked about everything from athletics to family to friends to how it was on death row. They would ask a million questions about what death row was like and death house and what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And so I would just answer their questions, just listen. Mainly it was listening.
After each execution, you recorded an audio tape account of the events, and these tapes, they figure prominently in this film. Let's listen to one of these tapes.
I held his right hand. He was squeezing very tight as they inserted the needle. Fortunately, it went quickly. He had previously asked me to stay in touch with him, so I moved down to touch his leg right above his ankle. The needle went in well on the right arm. The sodium tiopentol began to flow, and he began breathing slowly.
How do you feel when you hear that? When you hear yourself those many years ago?
I don't forget a one. I can. It's all in my heart and in my soul and my mind. I haven't forgotten any of those. I did those tapes for therapeutic value of myself. And they were locked above. They were never to be used by anybody.
Yeah, your children didn't know about them. We see them in the film, learn about the tapes. Mm-hmm. Why? Why did you want to keep them secret or locked inside?
First of all, they were for my own private therapy, if you want to call it that. One of my good friends, who was a psychiatrist who worked at the prison part-time, told me that everybody has a we're like a glass or a bowl, and you can take only so much. Everything that goes inside your spirit and your mind is like a drop, and eventually your drops fill up, and then one of them will overflow the glass. But which do you blame as the cause? The last drop, you can't blame that one, because if there hadn't been the first drop and the 23rd drop and the 30th drop. Mm-hmm. So I had to talk to something and somebody. And the only thing I had at home was the first night I came home from Charlie Brooks about 5 o'clock in the morning. I just saw it sitting over there and I said, I'm just going to go through this. I want to just talk it out. And so I would discuss everything that took place, word for word, and every event, everything took place, then I would seal it.
Why did you decide to make them public now?
Well, it has to do with I was so 100% certain that Carlos de Luna was innocent. And I had these sealed away. When the Chicago Tribune came to me, and they were doing their study, their investigation into the case of Carlos de Luna. They came to me and they said, we have a lot of evidence. Well, I had felt all along, after listening to Carlos, having been with him and having talked to his family most of that day when I wasn't with him, I had this complete feeling that Carlos is innocent.
Will you tell a little bit of his story?
It was in Corpus Christi, and a woman called in a 911. She was at a Sigmore service station and a drive-in, and she called in and she told the police that there was somebody outside her store, and they had a knife. And the police said, well, are they doing anything? She said, no. And they said, well, we can't do anything. Well, eventually somebody came in, and she got back on the phone, and she called, and she was hollering, and they recorded the fact that this man was assaulting her with a knife. And basically, here comes, you know, tons and tons of police. And Carlos was several blocks away, underneath a pickup truck. And th- they began to look around to find she was dead. And they began to look around, and they found Carlos. But Carlos had no blood on him. He had no blood on his shirt. He had no blood on his pants, no blood on his shoes. He had no blood at all.
And yet he was put away for her murder, right, and then put to death.
Right.
Would you say that was the turning point for you, where you realized that you were against the death penalty?
That was a major point. It began to grow back from the very beginning.
Hmm.
But when Charlie Brooks was executed, he had a fall partner. The fall partner is the one that's in on crime with him.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were there at the crime. And one of them snitched, which is a good word, told the police that he was there, but Charlie did the shooting. And then, so they gave him 8 years and they executed Charlie Brooks. And this happened too often. I began to see that. And then we had a fellow later on, about the third one in the road, was a fellow who was convicted and put to death, and he was 200 yards away from the crime. And as these things grew, I began to see that the system wasn't working right. There were too many people being put to death. Then they started putting to death people who were 17 years old, and that bothered me. And then it bothered me when I saw the mentally ill. And it just grew over time. And then Carlos, there were so many factors to Carlos.
He called you. You let him call you daddy when he died, because he said he never had a father, and he asked your permission. Did you feel, Pastor, that it was God's will that Carlos died, or did you ever get angry with God?
I didn't get angry with God. It does, you know, we don't get angry with God. There's so much free will in this world. And the whole story of Carlos de Luna is a group of prosecutors and people in Corpus that just didn't pay any attention and lied, just flat out and out lied. And there was no use to blame God for the selfishness and stupidity that went on in the prosecutors in Corpus Christi. And Carlos died as a result of somebody's sinfulness, not his, because he didn't commit a crime.
After witnessing so much death, do you fear it?
No. No, I don't fear death. I faced it last year. I had a surgery. I had a blood clot going to the heart, and I went on cloud blue, and I remember going to heaven. I remember seeing the clouds and all the things that the Bible talks about, and they rushed me to another hospital in Houston, and 3 days later, I hemorrhaged, and I went cold blue again, and I saw another vision of heaven, and I died twice within 5 days. I saw, as the Bible says, you know, there's a mansion for you in heaven. And I remember an angel walking me down the long trail leading up and showing me the door, and there was my name on the door.
I'm glad you didn't move into that mansion yet.
Me too.
Pastor Pickett, thank you so much for being here and telling us your story.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Pastor Carol Pickett was the death house chaplain at the Walls Prison Unit in Huntsville, Texas from 1982 to 1995, and his story is told in a new documentary, At the Death House Door. It premieres on IFC May 29th. For more about him and the film, go to our website, morefairgame.org.